Hello, welcome to the Munifest Destiny podcast, number 13. Munifest Destiny is a novel I wrote in 1991. The subtitle is The Rough and Ready Balloon Invasion of the Lunar Peninsula of Texas. My name is Peter Gelman. The novel is available on Kindle for 99 cents. In this episode, I will read chapter 12. So if this is the first time you're hearing this podcast, please start with episode 1. Thank you. Chapter 12, The Ding-Dang Bells of Plato's Crater. Come crack of dawn, those rascally moon men began bonging all their church bells like it was the end of the world. Clang, clang, bang. Their ringing pots and pans and chimes and gongs were enough to wake the dead and give them a headache. Bong, bang, bong, ding-a-din, dong-a-din, a cannonade of bells. They marched left, right, in brassy passion. For me, it was the beginning of a siege, for I had drunk too much Tennessee Old Hickory in tribute to General Jackson, the bank slayer. With Kelly and my wife, I mean my camp wife. Achingly, nigh 500 men rose in the dark to drag wheelbarrows and dump dirt on the roof of the bombproof. And just so, the construction of Fort Slowpoke was done. Din, 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 come crack of dawn, this clarion clatter called for a din-din of carrion. Just so, bong, bang, bong. Them lunar bells applauded our fort's readiness for warfare. It was a six-sided fort, each wall 133 yards long, making a perimeter of 800 yards. Each wall was 9.5 feet high, about 5 feet wide at the top, where the sentries stood, and much thicker at the bottom. Around the fort was a ditch, 8.5 feet deep, 20 feet wide where we finished it, 15 feet wide where we hadn't. We were less than 100 yards from the north shore of the Mare Frigoris, where it narrowed, so that the southern shore and the port of Matamunos was only another 200 yards across. "Assemble the men," Major Jacob Brown quietly told Captain Francis Lee. "Orders bellowed down the chain of command, each lower link a little louder." When the men of the 7th Infantry had arrayed themselves in our neat Euclidean rows, the rows that took the mob out of the mass, minus sentries and the 24 men of the 2nd Artillery, Company E, who were lovingly scrubbing and greasing their iron Buddha babies, we made more than 450 voters. Sarah, Martha, and all the other wives, along with Old Sock and the Prince President, Franklin Stove, all these non-voting non-combatants stood quietly beside the red-suited musics, who held their horns and cymbals at such at present arms. Their awful racket of martial music could repel a lunar bayonet charge better than a volley from our old muskets, which is why they earned $8 a month, while we privates earned $7. Martha Mule was braying, sort of lonesome and mournful. She didn't like those banging bells better than the rest of us brutes. She didn't like being cooped up in her own little fort, either. It was just a ditch in the yard. It was, in fact, the first 4 feet of Captain Edgar Hawkins attempted well. He'd figured he could tap the fresh water of the cold sea only 12 feet down, and in war, a fort well is worth a few cannon. But Captain Mansfield, the engineer, took his men away to dig the giant bomb-proof, which was more important. During the night, Lacking a corral, Martha Mule had moseyed around, the yard's vegetation lacking. She pulled down Martha Miles' straw hat from way up high on the laundry pole. It was 7 feet. She had to stand on her hind legs and maybe even climb a little. Martha Mule was part monkey, we figured. She ate the hat, paper flowers and all. Then she moseyed around some more, sniffed around, and poked her sniffer into the officer's tent, where, on the big tables set inside, there were some maps and charts of a fine cotton paper. Martha chewed a crescent chaw off of the great lunar map. Didn't like that, so she settled down to Captain Mansfield's fine fort specifications. With Major Brown and Martha Miles looking on, Old Sock dragged the mule into the unfinished well ditch, and that corralled her fine. Sometimes a mule's worth more than a well, anyway. The tips of her long ears showed, turning slowly this way and that, hearkening on them bells. She used to be called Princess Millig, named by PPFS, but after a few hours of dragging our dirt around, we all took a vote and renamed her in honor of the captain's wife. That was to try to pacify her righteous braying a bit by a measure of earthly humility. But it didn't work. The name, however, stuck. All of us stood waiting, eyes on our commander, while the bells of Plato's crater rang on, banging and clanging, on and on. Major Brown stood on the slope between the number 3 and 4 gun platform, beside the flagpole, the 7 captains lined behind him. The flag cut the lunar sky, whip-cracking its lightning stripes. "Men," he began solemnly, "it is my unhappy duty to tell you that American blood has been shed on American soil. 1 week ago, on the 24th of April, the lunar hussars who aimed to cut off communications between this fort and Fork Poke ambushed and slaughtered 16 dragoons patrolling Texas soil for the United States Army. We believe the remaining 47 to be held prisoner. Not only for them, but for the widows and orphans of Captain Seth Thornton and his men, this war has already begun. My friends, I fear the war has begun for us too, but we will stand firm, for we defend much more than a fort. On this side of the Mare Frigoris lives prosperity and democracy. On that side, poverty and despotism. We cotton balers defend the frontier of justice. As 30 years ago we whipped the Martians invaders at New Orleans, so today we will whip these lunar invaders here in Texas. As yesterday we cried, 54-40 or fight to protect our Oregon territory on Venus. Today we cry, the moon or bust, all the moon, to protect Texas right here. So shall we sail our steam balloons inward and outward across the spheres, forging by shot and shell, sword, an electric bayonet, an empire dedicated to liberty. And if after the moon we steam over the wilderness of the inner spheres and take all Venus and all Mercury, and then who knows, turn our eyes on the benighted outer spheres, who would dare raise their voice against us? We soldiers of democracy don't bring fire and famine. We bring freedom and prosperity. We bring our constitution and the popular vote. There is infinite space on our flag for more brethren of stars. The peninsula of Texas stands or falls with this fort. Starting right here, we will take, if need be, all the moon. For these reasons, our president has added another warning against the Martian empires to the Monroe Doctrine. The United States alone shall decide the destiny of the inner spheres. The million voices of democracy outshout any lisping protest from a dozen pretty dictators. From planet to planet, the inner spheres must fulfill the shining role inscribed to it by destiny. It is an old dream, one shared by our fellow former colonies. The children of George Washington and the children of Simón Bolívar belong to but one family, the family of freedom. That family can be and will be united under only one flag. And that flag, Cotton Balers, is our flag. Three cheers for Old Glory, bellowed Captain Edgar Hawkins, saluting the flag. Hip, hip, he began. Hurrah, we roared. Thrice our cry shouted down them bells of Plato's crater. But still they persisted to toll on and on and on. Yes, by gum, cried Kelly, lifting his shako on the point of his saber. We will emancipate the inner spheres. I could have kicked him. I mean liberate, not emancipate, he added with a half smile. Major Brown looked uncomfortable. A slight atmosphere of embarrassment wafted among the ladies. The men shifted slightly, confused. Major Brown pointed a finger at the musics, who began a jolly jumping and thumping Jimmy Crack Corn. But to me, this was as poor a choice of song as my brother's choice of word, emancipate. And as we all sung out, Jimmy Crack Corn and I Don't Care, My Master's Gone Away, the tune did not abolish the nasty, nasty banging of bells in my brain. Thank you for listening to this free podcast. I'm doing the best I can with the reading. Thank you for putting up with me. Are you familiar with the song, Jimmy Crack Corn? Okay, I'm going to read from the Wikipedia. Jimmy Crack Corn is thought to be a blackface minstrel song, first performed in the United States in the 1840s, and it remains a popular children's song today. Over the years, many variants of text have appeared, but the basic narrative remains intact. On the surface, the song is a black slave's lament over his master's death. The song, however, has a subtext of rejoicing over that death and possibly having caused it by deliberate negligence. Most versions at least nod to idiomatic African English, although sanitized standard English versions predominate today. So there's I'll give a synopsis of the lyrics. Okay, this is the actual lyrics. When I was young, I used to wait on the boss and hand him his plate and pass down the bottle when he got dry and brush away the blue-tailed fly. Jimmy Crack Corn and I Don't Care, repeated. My master's gone away. So then the synopsis is the slave singer is told to protect his master's horse from the bite of the blue-tailed fly. The horse bucks, and the master is killed. The slave then escapes guilt. There's a reference to a jury and a verdict, but the slave was not charged with the crime. Well, Wikipedia explores that. I think it's an unnecessary detail to get into right now. So basically, the fly bit the horse, and the horse bucked, and the master of the slave died. Now, I had to sing this song when I was a kid in Virginia, and I had no idea that either we were told or we were somehow aware that it was a slave song, and I think we sung a slightly sanitized version, I'm not sure. We certainly didn't get into the verses about the master dying. Looking at Wikipedia again, Jimmy Crack Corn may be a vernacular version of what's called Jim Crack Corn or cheap corn whiskey. I never knew that when I was a kid. And I guess that's the origin of the slang term cracker for a rural Southern American white person. Interesting. Okay. So obviously, I think it's pretty obvious. They're so strongly feeling that they are bringing freedom, and yet this is a slave-owning society. I think that many Americans who were not abolitionists were still, when forced to the point, were embarrassed. Were embarrassed, and they knew there was a problem there, even if they weren't abolitionists. So thanks for listening. Next chapter. Oh, before I close, I want to mention, I went to visit. There's a fort in Brownsville, Texas. And all that remains is a few of the walls. It looks to me like the rest of it was bulldozed. And where it was bulldozed, that's a little golf course. And I imagine the Rio Grande has shifted its position somewhat. It's very close. So there's a golf course, and there's a few walls of the dirt fort covered by grass. And the Daughters of the American Revolution organization fixed a monument. They have a cannon that's standing upright on its nozzle. That's the only sign that there's any kind of historic recognition of what is so important to me. And right across the river, quite nearby, you could see Matamoros, or that the book calls Matamunos. And cold sea of the Rio Grande. And the historical museum in Brownsville helped me a lot. They had on display a letter, very neatly written diagram of the fort showing the dimensions. And if you recall, in the beginning of this chapter, I read out the dimensions of the fort. I took it from that document written by an officer who was there. Okay, next chapter. One thing I want to mention, that I believe that really happened before the open hostilities started. For the people in the fort, all the bells in Matamoros rang. Okay, in the next chapter, Jack considers luck and thinks of a way to change it, and also discusses his relationship with Sarah, his camp wife. Thanks again for listening.